You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and if you can hear some background noise, you might be able to faintly hear some barely recognisable R&B, I think, in the background. That's because I am backstage at the Hot Water Comedy Club in Liverpool, where I've been enjoying a fantastic weekend of gigs here. And I'm very pleased to say that whilst I was here, I managed to snag not only brilliant comic Marcus Birdman, but also the phenomenon that is Paul Smith. So we've got two cracking episodes in the can with those guys racked up, ready to come out in the next few weeks. I am taking advantage of this, you know, in the way that we're all trying to do 10 things at once these days. So while I'm away from home, I'm like, right, I'm going to do all my admin, going to get a load of podcasts, going to do a bunch of gigs, and also record some blurbs. Well, here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm thrilled today to be bringing you an episode with Ahir Shah, someone I've been aware of for a long time. I've not gigged with him quite as often as many of my contemporaries. I guess I'm at a stage now when someone like Ahir, I think of him as very much a newer comic, which is preposterous because he's done, as you'll hear, what, 7-8 hours at Edinburgh? He's been cracking on in no uncertain terms. Award nominated, celebrated. Just in the last couple of years, he's really started to break through and get lots of traction. And his material has been, it's always been intelligent. And now, as you will hear, he delights in taking big, big political and philosophical ideas. And, I mean, I don't want to give too much away unless you've read the show notes, but he has such a good analogy for what he does with those ideas to package them up, to reduce them, compress the air out of them, and turn them into zingy, pithy, short jokes, which nonetheless say a great deal. So with thanks to the Angel Comedy Club at the Bill Murray in Angel in London for their recording space, this is Ahir Shah. We start with your voice, Ahir.
Yes,
you have you have the voice that you have. Tell me about your voice.
Yes, it's a curious one. So basically, sort of every year in the Edinburgh show, I have to have something about it near the top just to explain, mm-hmm. like the sheer incongruity of what's going, or rather the perceived incongruity of the distance between me being a brown man and sounding like I've been colonised by my own voice, as yeah, I generally have it. But yeah, it is genuinely, like, the story that I tell in stand-up is the truth. It's like, basically, when, and this happened, like, it's not an uncommon thing among first-generation immigrant communities, but it's because when my grandparents brought my mother and their other children over here, they banned them from speaking Gujarati outside of the house and told them that they had to speak in this sort of received pronunciation accent in an effort to assimilate, generally. Okay. And so it's with, like, that thing that a generation ago became affect, or sorry, was affect, then through the decades just became the way that Mum speaks, and that then eventually became the way that I speak.
So why haven't I heard anyone else who is a brown man speaking with your specific accent? Why so much so in your case?
There are a few. I've met a few others who sound like me, perhaps not in comedy, but yeah.
Like, is it unusual amongst British Asians? Like, I understand the origin,
yeah.
But did your parents particularly go hard with it?
I think particularly the influence of my grandfather probably had a big thing, because he was very much one for sort of, like, staid appearances were very important, very small-C conservative man. So I think it made sense that he wanted his family and stuff to kind of go in that way.
Okay.
But yeah, I think, like, for me, it was always a certain way. And then when I went to university and there were lots of fancy white people, probably started going...
great description of Cambridge.
Yeah, there were lots of fancy whites.
Lots of fancy white people.
Yeah. It's just like, holy shit, I really am in a minority. I had no idea. Like,
yeah.
Like, well, I grew up in London and in Wembley, and so my high school was the local comp and was just, you know, like third Indian, Pakistani, that sort of area, third Afro-Caribbean, yeah, third sort of everything else.
Yeah.
And so none of us ever felt that we were members of a particular minority,
yeah,
until we either watched television or went outside the area that we lived and all of our friends lived. So it was only in the later teens that I was like, oh, right, that's what people are talking about when they say ethnic minority.
Really? Talk to me about the very beginning. Let's get further into that. That's fascinating. Because, I mean, and it's one of those things, as soon as you hear it, you go, oh, well, obviously.
Yeah.
But before hearing it, oh, yeah, I wouldn't have expected that at all. So what did that feel like to... I mean, you must have had a sense beforehand. You said that's what people are talking about when they say minority.
Yeah. So, like, you were sort of aware that, in inverted commas, this thing of being an ethnic minority existed.
Okay.
And what have you. But that was never your just visual lived experience, right? Because if, you know, say I'm 11 and my Mondays to Fridays are I'm at school with a bunch of other people who are also, in inverted commas, ethnic minorities, but there are so many,
sure,
and of such equal proportions that it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
It was like, if anything, it's the white English people who there are very few of.
Yeah.
Here. And then at the weekends, where am I going? Like, I'm 11 years old, I'm seeing like my grandma or something. Like, mm-hmm, I'm not. And once again, in a very South Asian part of Northwest London, because she lived in Alperton, or lives in Alperton. So yeah, you just don't, like, you don't visually see it in much the same way that I've been a lifelong Londoner, if I'd never left London, and obviously I do travel around extensively through the job, and stuff, but if I'd not left London, I would just not be conscious of the fact that the demography of London were different to the rest of the country, right?
Okay, yeah, sure. So when you went to Cambridge, was that kind of a big moment for you, realising... Was that a moment of realisation, or was it prior to that?
I think I'd clocked before then, because sort of in my late teens, made friends with people who were at, like, from other parts of, okay, London and at different sorts of schools. And so as a result of that, became a bit more aware of it. But still, the sheer extent you only realise when you're sort of in a place where people from all over are. And then travelling around with this as well. I think one of the great shames is that a lot of people don't get to see a great deal of the country that they actually live in, which, yeah, we are very lucky to be able to do.
I think of that all the time. I forget it, and I keep re-noticing that, oh, God, I'm incredibly geographically well-versed.
Yeah, because, yeah. So, for example, my sister has travelled all around the world, like, very extensively internationally travelled person, but as would be fairly normal, other than London, where she grew up and now lives, and she was at uni in Warwick, and then my brother-in-law's family lived near Wolverhampton, so she goes there, and she's been to, like, a few when she was younger, just where boyfriend's families, mm-hmm, were from and what have you. But other than that, like, why would you? Like, we just sometimes go to Leeds on a Thursday.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. In a way that people don't do, because, yeah, it's enormously inconvenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, why would you? Yeah. So did you experience much racism, given that you were in a less ethnically diverse group, or less, what's the terminology for fewer white people around?
I think that there was almost certainly, like, there were bits, but it was just sort of like, at school certainly, it was just sort of childhood needling of one another, and we were all sort of in the sort of non-dominant group.
Sure.
Like, in a wider social context and everything. So you were never really able to punch down in a huge way
yeah, fair enough,
when we were kids. And then sort of have become more aware of it sort of as I've got older, principally through moving in different sorts of spaces and travelling as,
yeah,
much as I have.
Yeah.
But I feel as though, like, generally speaking, I think that if I lived where I lived, worked in the same place somewhere in London on a 9-to-5 generally, then I probably wouldn't be personally that aware.
Yeah.
Of it, I would be sort of in a wider sense aware.
Sure, because it strikes me that your crusade if you like, throughout comedy. Maybe that's a terrible term.
Yeah.
But your mission in comedy, your way of making meaning in comedy is less to do with political change. You do cover politics, obviously, but it feels more philosophical. And I'm wondering whether that is because of a particular way in which you grew up.
Well, I don't really know. So I think that I wouldn't describe myself as a political comedian. I have in the past done shows, and one particular show that was very intensely political, and that was the 2017 one, and because that was the first one that was nominated for the award and what have you and did quite well, that sort of got people, oh, that's what that guy does.
Sure.
Which sort of put me in a box for a little while, which but I then didn't I also really like.
In the Facebook group, the ComCom Facebook group, I recently posted a video I dug up of yours online whilst researching you, of you 10 years ago, frankly looking like it was 30 years ago. Tiny. And you were talking, like, I don't know how old you were. It was
17.
Do you remember this?
Been,
you were 17.
Yeah.
And you were talking about politics. You were talking about wanting to change the world. You were talking about...
Yeah. No, I've now...
You were about to go to Cambridge, and you were concerned in the video, in the interview, you were concerned that at Cambridge they would spot that really you wanted to be a comedian whilst you were ostensibly there to study politics.
Yeah, but it turned out that that wasn't that much of an issue because lots of people ended up going there because they wanted to be comedians.
Sure.
But, yeah, like, I think that, generally speaking, what I'm trying to do, and once again, as you have... As you have told me, your favourite parts are always the parts where someone's about to go, and this is going to sound pretentious, so let's do one of them quite early on,
sure.
Why not? But I think particularly when you're the type of comic who, the second you walk out, there's, in inverted commas, a thing that people notice about you and what have you, then you've got two options there. Either you're like, that's what I'm really going to hammer home the entire time, or, okay, that's a thing that's part of my being, but not the entirety of my being, and let's deal with that, and then we can go on to a wider thing. So I wanted to, just generally in the stuff that I write and make, wanted to give maybe a more three-dimensional view of being a human being, particularly from the perspective of someone who is quite often two-dimensionalized, if that makes sense, in other sorts of mainstream portrayals. So to me, it's much more interesting to go into, like, I like talking about, well, I don't like talking about, but get some sense of catharsis talking about sort of things in my life or things that I'm not particularly happy about or made me mentally unwell or what have you. And that's far more interesting to probe deeper, to my mind, into the individual rather than sort of looking outward entirely.
I don't disagree with you. You're frowning, so I wondered if you were going to continue.
No,
that's fine. So, lots of different things to work with there. I think before we move on from your voice, I want to just, as it pertains to education.
Yeah.
So, what was your degree in politics?
Yeah.
How did you find that degree, given your hidden agenda to become a comic?
I absolutely loved it. Well, I didn't really know for a fact that I wanted to go into comedy later because I ended up really, really enjoying the degree that I did and wanted actually to pursue academia for a little while longer and applied for a master's and was resolutely rejected because my personal statement was effectively an acrostic poem saying, please don't make me go into the real world right now. I'm so desperately unready. And I think that they saw through that quite reasonably and quite quickly. They're clever people, it turns out. But yeah, I loved it. My director of studies there remains the smartest person I've ever met, and I still really like hanging out with her and talking about just state of everything. And yeah, those sorts of things where I miss a situation in some ways where you could just be like standing around three people chucking a ball about and talking about shit that 19-year-olds have absolutely no business talking about. Like, we could change the world, man.
I can't imagine. I've never done a politics degree. I've done a degree, but just barely, you know. Is it a lot of discourse based? What's it like? What's it like? The picture you paint there is wanting to change the world through it. Was that reflected in the other people on your course?
Everyone.
Or is it you? Does you think politics and because I want to change the world?
I don't know. I think that probably before I went, I thought that that's what politics meant. And afterwards became much more interested in the philosophy and theory and stuff behind it rather than any sort of practical politics, which always just seemed quite grubby and gross to me. But yeah, it was very sort of discourse-based, where because we had these lovely like supervision things where it would just be like one-on-one or one-on-two, and you would be sat on a sofa opposite a world-leading academic in their field who was pretending that you kind of like very graciously pretending that they hadn't already thought of everything that you were about to say.
Okay.
And yeah, it was just really fun. Like, it's just, but it was nice. Like, in the same way that I feel like a lot of comedy is like, you're justifying breaking the silence when you walk onto a stage, and you're like, what is the point of you being here and doing this in front of us? Come on, yes. Like, earn this. And similarly, that sort of environment where you're constantly being needled on a why and explain yourself properly, like, yeah. Go for it. Like, I think helps just as a way of thinking, even when you're thinking about just like, how can I get every tag out of this bit possible? Or like, have I rung this hard enough? Am I getting everything that I can out of it?
What did you say, that when you walk out on a stage, people, like, the thought in the audience is, I want to just say exactly what you said,
yeah,
what possible reason have you got to be here?
Yeah.
Justify. So what reason do you have to be there on stage and stand up?
It is now my only marketable skill.
Yeah, I know. I mean, come on, we all think that.
Yeah, but like, I just think like, I have shit that I want to say, and I think it's interesting, and for as long as people seem to agree, then great. Like, I certainly wouldn't want to get out. Like, you do have this stuff where, you know, it can happen with your own bits or something. Like, say, walk out on stage and you're just doing, right, it's Friday night, central London, you're doing two, three things, going to hop between them, and you find yourself telling a six-year-old joke that just feels like it's ash in your mouth as it's coming out. And you're like, right, okay, need to not do that anymore, because I'm certain people can tell that the heart isn't in this. Mm. But then when you're doing something that the heart properly is in, and that sort of flurry of, you know, the moth flock in the gut and all of that, like, just bursting out, and then you get the immediacy of the response of they're like, yes, or they're like, never do that again, and both ways are so exciting.
Such a joy to talk to. I hear he's such an intelligent guy, and we should have some sort of version of ComCom Bingo whereby you can spot a word that's never been said on the podcast before and tick it off some kind of a list. Maybe someone could start keeping a list on the Facebook group for us. I'm put in mind of the Marcus Birdman episode I recorded today, where he talked about the rhythm and the meter of what he says, and it suddenly made me think, oh, I don't think anyone's used the word meter before in that context on the pod. So anyway, feel free to contribute to that, and indeed join the Facebook group to just sort of become part of that community. It's really good fun at the moment. It's getting a little bit bee heavy. There's a running joke about bees that you'll be aware of if you're a long-term listener, and every so often I really have to storm through the Facebook group and prune all the bee memes. But the stuff that isn't bee memes, it tends to be very sophisticated, intelligent, warm, and 99% of the time very friendly and well thought out comedy chat, people sharing spare tickets to things as well, and generally just everyone's just really lovely there, and I'm really proud of it. I'm really enjoying it. So by all means, join up to that if you like. Thank you to everyone that's been coming out to the live shows. And it's all about Edinburgh now. We're all gearing up. I've been, like I said, I'm at Hot Water right now in Liverpool, and I've been sneaking in little bits ahead of Primer, which is the work in progress hour that I'm going to be doing. Never done a work in progress hour in Edinburgh before, and I'm really excited about the idea of just changing stuff up all the time from day to day. I really hope and expect that what I start off with, which is going to be very higgledy-piggledy, will be vastly different from what I'm doing in the middle of the festival, and vastly different again from what I'm doing at the end. So come several times and hold me to that. I know that some of you who are the more diehard Goldsmith watchers might well take me up on that, and that would be quite useful to continue to spur me to keep cycling in newer stuff, writing every day. That's the plan. Write every morning, do the show at Monkey Barrel at 3 o'clock every day. And by all means, have a Google at edfringe.com. Go to edfringe.com and search my name or the word Primer, and you can get tickets in advance, because it is a ticketed show. You can take a risk and just turn up and get in for free.
But it may well have sold out, and I think tickets are a fiver. So if you want to secure yourself a place, go to the website and... or is it... Well, I can never remember. The Monkey Barrel Comedy Club have got... They've got the domain either fringe.com or fringe.co.uk. I can't remember. Have a check for one of those and it might see you right. So that's all of that stuff. I'll have a little post-amble at you at the end. Don't miss out on seeing Ahir live. He's an extraordinary act. So passionate, so intelligent, and very, very funny. Very consistently proper laugh-out-loud funny. So track him down on the internet and go and see him live somewhere. I mean, this is what I'm always saying. I think in almost all cases for my guests, by all means, find them doing bits and bobs on YouTube. But go and see Ahir live. He's going to be back at the Edinburgh Festival, so if you're up there, add him to your list. We'll have Spreadsheet Day fairly soon, which, as you may know, is when we get together and everyone posts and I retweet. We put in the Facebook group and on Twitter, at ComComPod. And we could probably do it on Instagram, at ComComPod as well, if I ever get around to using Instagram. I mean, I use it, but, you know, do I use it? So everyone puts photos of their, or screenshots of their plans for Edinburgh, because what's the record? What's the most number of shows you can fit into a day? If you think you hold the record, and it's got to be 8+, surely people out there are doing 8 shows in a day. If you think you've seen more than 8 shows in a day, then let us know on the internet somehow. If you need to contact me for any reason, you can do that info@comedianscomedian.com. And thank you for all your emails. I answer every single one of them. And if you've not heard back from me, you are in a special folder called Respond to This as Soon as You Get a Free Second. So you genuinely are in that folder. So I do get back to everyone. And finally, before we get back into this interview with Ahir, if you'd care to join the Insiders Club with a regular monthly donation to support the podcast at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, then you can find 20 minutes worth of extra material from this episode as Ahir tells us not only his reasoning in moving from the Free Fringe, where he's been nestling very happily for some years, to Monkey Barrel. We will be stable mates there. Not only the reasoning behind that, and we talk a little bit about the financial implications and the audience growth implications of the Free Fringe model versus paid versus the sort of kind of mix and match approach of venues like Monkey Barrel. But also Ahir will tell us in the extras how he's preparing to appear on Have I Got News For You, which he's doing very soon. And he'll tell us as well what one thing he will have in his head that actually makes him feel relaxed about going into a TV recording. I was very pleased to hear that. So that's all at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And now let's return to this conversation with Ahir Shah.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So do you think that that background of being with an academic and arguing a point or exploring ideas, that feels like that forms a pretty strong core of your kind of the kernel of you as a comic?
Yeah. And I think... I think a big consequence of that is realizing that I always... really enjoyed those like discursive sessions and the argument and trying to get to the core of something, and was also aware that the sort of books that I was reading or something were written by academics for academics and were never going any further. And I was like, these things contain such interesting ideas about society and the world and stuff, but have an audience of 12, right? Mm. And this just isn't getting out in any way. And I think, like, stand-up is the closest that we can get to, like, the sort of public oratory that doesn't really happen much anymore. Like, nerds go to lectures like idiots. I go to lectures like an idiot. But basically you're like, oh, right. There's the wonderful thing that Lenny Bruce says of the, like, duty of the stand-up comedian is to make an audience laugh at minimum once every X number of seconds, whatever it is, right? And you realise that, right, we're united by an end, the means can be as varied as we would like them to be, right? And so... the other way around. So you realise that we're united by a means, but the end can be whatever we want.
Okay.
Right? So whether you choose to tell one-liners that get people laughing every 15 seconds, or you've decided to talk about something intensely personal or what have you, as long as you're making people laugh, you can hit a much wider audience for what you would hope are interesting ideas than you perhaps otherwise would if you were writing some dry academic tome.
And was that kind of a light bulb moment for you to think, oh, actually, through stand-up, I can... Like, how far into your stand-up practice did that realisation come, that you could, I can communicate big, complex ideas? Because you are, I think, amongst comics, certainly amongst British comics, you are a real standard-bearer for, here is a big, complex idea. If I say all of these words, you know, your stuff is very... It seems very densely written. Not all of it, but the big idea stuff is... If I say this and that and that and that, I can bring you with me, and now you get it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you've got big... I remember when I saw a preview of Duffer in Corsham.
Yeah.
There was just huge volumes of, like, this idea, right? With me. Little joke about Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah. And now pay attention again to this big thing. So did you realise you could do that, and that's what made you want to do comedy? Or were you doing comedy and realised that you could do that?
I think definitely the latter, was doing comedy and realised that I could do it. And I think it's in part been a process to... So when making stand-up shows, I work with a director, a fantastic director, Adam Brace, who has...
Barnacles Brace.
So, yeah. Love it. But basically, he has been really good, because my natural inclination is always, why one line when three would do, you know? And so he's been very good at... holding back my worst instincts and trying to augment the better, which I think is what a good stand-up director should do. And it was, I think, probably in the first time that I was working with him, which would be like 5 years ago now or something like that, where he was like, I was just labouring a point, and he was like, we get it in the first line. And the reason is because there's a joke. And then you realise that, like, I think of a joke like a zip file, you know, and you tell someone a joke and they're unzipping it in their head, and all of a sudden all of this information has sprung out from this tiny, tiny kernel, because in the release of the laugh, you only laugh if you get it, right? And so you're able to, you know, in seven words perhaps, carry out some sort of very large idea that people then can entirely do for themselves within the next second, and you can move on.
And whereas your tendency, when you say your worst instinct, is to present people with a PDF with all the information and the diagrams.
See what I did there? See what I did
That is that's brilliantly put. And what's fascinating about that... What's fascinating about that is it's a good example of itself.
Yeah.
I like it. Yeah. I like that a lot.
Yeah. So basically, if Brace had been here, he would have been like, oh, you could have told him that in like 10 seconds. Yeah. You know, it's 4 minutes of his life.
The zip file analogy. The zip file. You know, a way of describing a much more complicated thing, like this metaphor. Oh, I love it. Love it.
Worst enemy as ever.
Yeah. Well, so where does that instinct come from for you to say more than you need to? Because I've watched your shows for a long time, and I think I've made the observation possibly to you in the past. I feel like I've picked up on that you, and I think a review put it quite well. I read a review, only ever for research, never read them, they're not for us. But for research purposes, I read a review that says you, I think it was something like, you are happy to wear your intelligence on your sleeve. And do you feel that's fair?
Probably. Like, definitely more so when, like, I think paradoxically that sort of thing happens much more when you're less confident in what you're doing. So when I was younger, that was much more the case. In previews, it's much more the case. And sort of now, I hope, gets largely cut out by Edinburgh time. But there's a sort of, like... tendency to fall back on because it's something that I feel like I can control. So if a bit in a preview isn't like working out the way that I thought it would work in my head, then you get to know that, oh, but don't you realize how incredibly clever it all is? And you're like, retrospectively, you're like, no one wants to fucking hear that. Come on. Like, sure. Maybe put a joke in it and then they'll actually enjoy.
So give us an example of, or in fact, what's the biggest idea you've managed to zip into a joke? And you can take as long as you need to think about this, because I'm sure you'll have a good answer for it. But in terms of the complexity of an idea that you've managed to put into a sentence or two, that you're really like, nailed that one.
Do you mind if I look at a doc?
Absolutely not. I'd love you to. And I wouldn't ask this of most people, but I feel like I've got a big brain here that I want to... whatever you do to brains...
I think I definitely know what it is. Basically, in the last show, I had a sort of running thing of Bohemian Rhapsody lyrics going through it, which originated in the fact that my dad once found the lyrics of Bohemian Rhapsody in my handwriting and thought that I'd written it when I was 8 years old. but anyway, so that sort of teed up a thing, and I would try to then use callbacks to the song anytime I needed to puncture a particularly emotionally difficult moment, right? So I had talked about being the last person my uncle spoke to before he killed himself, and my parents explaining this to me on the couch when I was 15 and me not being able to believe it and thinking, is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Do you like that? It's from a poem I wrote when I was 8. Or like when I was on antidepressant medication, became much more the sort of guy who was, you know, like little high, little low, anyway the wind blow, didn't really matter to me. And then at the end, discussing my grandmother's dementia and realizing that that's pretty much how it ends for all of us, in some sort of like terribly sad indignity, sometimes wish I'd never been born at all. And I think those things always like helps to both inject a moment of levity and just would it almost recompress the larger things that I'd been talking about and put them in quite a like swift, palatable way.
Definitely. And I think that is an excellent structure to your show. To push you on this, I don't think that's quite what I mean in terms of what I'm after is, I don't disagree with anything you said. I think and it's excellent. I remember laughing at it very much. But I think what I'm trying to steer you towards is a joke which contains a lot of working out in it. So you do us a short joke, but we get... I mean, almost an example, that one about your voice, my body's been colonised by itself.
That's one that I was thinking of just now.
Sure.
Like, yeah, potentially, my name's Ahir Shah, let's get the obvious out of the way. I realise that I sound as though I've been colonised by my own voice. And in that, I think, yeah, you probably are learning a lot about a character within that few words.
Yes, the fact that you're talking about, the fact that you're using that, the joke itself, the idea of colonizing.
I know, I'm aware of the history.
Okay. So where are you now? Are you going to Edinburgh again?
Oh, buddy.
Back on the antidepressant, presumably. Yeah. There's some stressors in your life.
Oh, God, I realised, it was basically sort of during the last Fringe, where I realised, oh, God, like, I'm just so tired immediately after doing the show. And, like, what is happening? Like, I'm sure that it wasn't... And then I just realised I was running on serotonin fumes for the entirety of the month, because it's the first one that I'd done in a long time where I was off then, which sort of lasted for about a year. But, yes, I'm now back on and ready to go another round with...
And you're in a... Do you feel under pressure? So 2 years ago you got nominated...
Yes, and last year as well.
And last year you got nominated as well?
Yeah.
I'm contained within that is me realising you didn't win either of those times.
No.
Nominations. I try not to. What's the word? If I could remember the word, this would be a clever point.
It's fine, Stuart. I'm aware enough for both of us.
Fine, thank you. There we go. Very, very gracious. Okay, so do you feel... pressure? Do you feel contextual pressure that this one's got to be even better? Or how do you feel about the awards? You're getting recognition. You're doing very well. You're selling out long runs at Soho. I believe you've got Something Sexy on TV coming up. Are you doing...
Have I got news for you?
Yeah. So it's all going off. Do you need to do well at Edinburgh?
I think that... it's more a thing that one wants to do for oneself, right? In the sense that, like, yes, I feel the pressure of this one needs to be better than the last one, but not for external factors, just because that's the way that I feel that you should feel with any sort of creative endeavour, because that's what... Or really any endeavour, right? Because
sure.
it's what propels you to do better the
Absolutely.
Next time. The minute that you get like, oh, this'll do, and I'll just coast now, then A, you're going to bore yourself, because you're not setting yourself any challenges, and B, you're going to bore everyone who's spent their time and money in order to engage with the thing. So I think, like, this year there's a bit of nervousness in the sense that it took a lot longer this year to work out what it was that I wanted to talk about. And that's sort of crystallizing in my head now. So, I mean, there's the sort of general incumbent stress, but I don't think it's from a sort of external, like, oh, what will the review say or what will the awards say? While all of that is very nice, it's more just like consistently wanting to make something that makes the last one feel like, oh yeah, that was the sort of thing that I was doing back then, and oh, isn't that like...
Yeah, I mean, given, however, that your last two shows have been not just very well received, not just excellent pieces of work in their own right, but one of them was very politically... I don't just mean a hot take, but it was politically rigorous and passionate and timely, and your more recent one, as well as being all of those things, was also this incredibly kind of personal story about your mental health and the lives of your family and your uncle's suicide, your life of your grandmother. Like that, like it wouldn't be coasting to kind of go, whew, okay, let's, you know what I mean? Like, or do you feel like, where are you with it now? Are you thinking that you need to out? Do you think that for your own satisfaction, you need to, I don't mean outdo, but to somehow improve upon the gravity and the passion of those shows?
I don't necessarily mean in terms of, like, needing to go deeper into things internally, because, firstly, you would hope that fewer bad things happen over time. Like, it would be lovely to have nothing to talk about. One year that will happen, and I will be blissfully away from
Happy
Edinburgh.
Guy. Yeah. Not appearing at this festival. Yeah. Happy Guy, show cancelled.
But I just mean in the sense that you always want the challenge of, like, ah, this one should have more laughs than the last one, mm-hmm. or just be like a funnier piece of comedy, because that's what you're doing, like, fundamentally as a comedian, like, whatever it is that you're talking about, you're building everything out of jokes, and just trying to build a taller tower of jokes every year is in and of itself an exciting prospect and a good challenge to set oneself, I think. So, yeah, I certainly don't mean that, like, I need to plumb even further into the depths and be like, oh, guys, if another one of you could get a terminal illness real quick, then that would be a real boon to Shah. Yeah, I just mean, like, try and make a new piece of comedy that I'm happy with and contains better jokes.
And what are your, at this stage, what are we now, May?
Yeah.
What are your stressing factors to do with your writing of the new show? Do you have, like, one of my perennial fears is that I'll run out. I won't have anything left to write jokes about. I'll run out of subjects. As soon as you move into a new bit, you're like, that's preposterous. And as soon as you're used to that new bit, you go, but what if I run out now? Like, that's a particular thing of mine. Do you have any sort of built-in, kind of almost like go-to negative thoughts about the process?
Well, there's I'm reminded of, there's a lovely line of Frank O'Hara's poetry, which I've been thinking about a lot recently, from the Meditations in Emergency, where he says, each time my heart is broken, I become more adventurous, but one of these days there'll be nothing left with which to venture forth. And that's kind of how I think that feeling often goes. I think that the nerviness is, like, at this stage, there's a lot of, like, trying out new bits, and afterwards people being like, are you all right?
okay. What sort of bits? What are we doing? What do you have a subject? Is it that people are asking because you're talking about your mental health? Or
Yeah. And it's just like, you want to make it so, like, it's like, no, I'm talking about this because this is a thing that I find interesting to talk about. And I am, the very fact that I am talking about it means that to some extent I'm clearly okay discussing it, so that's fine. But you want to, like, you know, you just want to get rid of that tension that people sometimes feel. And, you know, you see their bodies clutching up and it's like, right, we're not going to make a laugh come out of that physical form right now. So I think, like, that's a bit of a worry of just trying to, and it's what something like the Bohemian Rhapsody thing really helped with in the last show, of just needing some sort of levity in order to lift the moments of otherwise, oh God, I remember someone saying that during a preview last year in like June or something. I was at the 40 minute mark of the show and someone just in the audience was like audibly, oh God. Yeah, you're right, that bit is too bleak and that will be fit. That's why we do them. That's why we do the previews. So, yeah, just hoping that that sort of thing gets fixed.
And what other things do you have to cope with between now and Edinburgh? What sort of things? I'm feeling that this might be a sort of separate strand to the podcast. You know, I'm fond of asking people if they're happy. I think I'm going to get into asking, like, what things do you have to cope with and how do you cope with them?
Yeah, well, I think, like, so a big thing with this show is that I had thought previously that it was largely going to be about a particular relationship, and I'm no longer in that particular relationship, and that kind of meant that relatively late in the thinking it through process, it all had to change quite markedly. And so it's a weird one because I think I'm still sort of working out how I feel about all of that at the same time as trying to work out what this is going to be and how this all fits together. And but just I'm quite keen to in some ways avoid a repetition of what happened last year, because you think about Edinburgh and you think, oh, I'm doing this show in Edinburgh, but actually I finished touring Duffer 2-3 weeks ago. Right, and so actually it was something that the initial experience and idea for it happened in November 2017, and I was keeping on talking about this stuff until April 2019, a lot of it which was quite difficult stuff to talk about from a personal and familial perspective. And that I was very, very happy to do, because these are the stories of people I love, and their stories I think are important to share with people. But I think that's also a thing that I've got in the back of my head at the moment of, like, don't write about present sadness that you hope won't be future sadness. Like, there's no point in me in April 2020 discussing feelings that ideally I won't
really
be feeling.
May. Yeah, sure.
Exactly. You're like, what's the point? So, yeah, I think that that's a sort of odd one where I'm trying to sort of simultaneously work out how my life fits together and work out how this fits together at the same time.
Does it cost you something to do, to tour material, to create material that is so familiarly important? Does it, like, if you, in the most kind of obvious example, if you're writing some jokes about your uncle's suicide and you do a gig and the gig goes badly and the jokes about it don't work, Does part of you want to kind of run away from that and go, I shouldn't be doing jokes about this?
No, so the only time that that happened on this tour was when I was in Bedford and there was just a large contingent of very, very drunk people in the audience. But the sort of, with Duffer, the more, like, the descent or ascent or descent into the more emotional elements started about 20-25 minutes into the tour show. And so by that point I had a sense of what I was going to get from that room and just made the internal decision of, right, you won't get this stuff because I know that in this environment this is not the right environment for it.
Okay.
And there will be a bad reaction, I will feel terrible, I'll probably say something that I shouldn't, and I was just like, guys, a lot of the first half ended up just being taken up with chat with these people. And then for the second half, I was like, I'm just going to do bits from the old show.
In order to safeguard the material and yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a real shame and very nicely, actually, there were a couple who were there back in November who messaged me after the show at the Bloomsbury Theatre that I closed off the UK tour with on the 4th of April. And they messaged saying, by the way, we were at the Bedford thing and we came down to London to watch it tonight so that we could actually see it. And they very much enjoyed it, which was really nice. But yeah, so it was like, it's got to be in an environment that's conducive to that sort of thing actually taking place.
Yeah. What sort of other things? How long have you been doing stand-up now?
I did my first gig 14 years ago.
Good Lord. How many
hours? Oh, no, 13 years
ago. How many hours have you done?
7.
Okay. What have the light bulb
It was
moments?
A bad idea, just so everyone knows. It wasn't, like, it wasn't smart.
To do what, sorry? To...
Well, just in the sense that, like, I just started very young and I was like, yeah, sure, this, why not? Like, if I'd actually had any sense of I want to do a career in this thing, that I would definitely have gone about it in a vastly different way.
What would you have done differently?
But there's no way that I would have done my debut Edinburgh show when I was 20. What the hell did I have to say? Nothing, right? Like, what does a 20-year-old really kind of...
Was it a funny show? Was it still a... Was it a good show? I mean, let's analyse it. Yeah. Review your first hour.
I think that I had a thing... until probably my fourth hour, where I was sort of, you know, like an under-18 footballer might be, you'd be like, oh, he's good for his age, but you wouldn't have him in the first team.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
And so I had that for a few years.
Because, and then, specifically why?
I think just because I was firstly trying to run before I could walk, hadn't really done my time properly on the circuit, just working out how to be a comic. And so was doing things that one should do after finding one's voice before I'd done that.
I feel like I know what you mean, but, like, specifically what? Just given that there'll be people listening to this who are 20, who are considering their first hour, what sorts of things should you not have done?
Oh, and maybe, like, you may well be a 20-year-old who does have that and can do that. I'm just saying I probably wasn't. That's not to denigrate the ability.
No, absolutely.
But I just think, like, I think it was probably just, like, the accumulation of life experience that's necessary before you can actually have a conducive... Like, to have your voice as a comedian is to be able to walk out on stage and say, this is me, and have a very, like, clear thing of what that is. But the younger you are, just the more malleable you are, right? Just generally speaking. And so there is no proper identifiable you. It's like, oh, I'm all of these different things that I'm getting from all around the place, and I'm trying to echo this comedian who I really like, or that comedian who I really like, or this thing that I really enjoy reading or listening to or what have you. And all of those things eventually kind of merge in a pot to become the you that you then present those few years down the line, but you don't have it when you're that young. But then I don't know if anyone does have it with the first couple of shows that they do, because the first couple are always going to be sort of an amalgam of all your influences and those sorts of things.
Let's talk about antidepressants.
I thought you said dinner presents.
Let's talk about your dinner presents. It's a German term.
I was once... we had in the last house that I lived in before the current one, we had a couple over who were friends with one of my housemates, and their thing was every time they went over somewhere for dinner, they'd bring scratch cards for everyone, and that would be like a thing to do after dinner.
Oh,
and I think that's
nice.
A really neat...
Dinner presents.
Yeah. That's a great dinner present.
That's a lovely idea. Yes, for birthdays, I have a particular friend where we get each other speciality bets. Things like that, you know, so it's a lot of fun. Let's zero in on Edinburgh. How is your mental health during the Edinburgh Festival, which is one of the most gruelling times of a comic's career? Mm. Or is it? Is it more or less gruelling than being on tour? Do you have a support act on tour?
No.
So just you...
That's probably more grueling because you're alone. I think, like, I really like Edinburgh and don't get the people who are like, oh, this is awful, then why are you here every year? You know, no one's making you do this. So I do enjoy... I think, like, the part of doing comedy that I find most difficult is the standard loneliness of it. And particularly when you're on tour and you realise, like, my voice feels weird. Oh, it's because it's 7 p.m. and I've just said the first thing to another human being that I've said all day. Yeah. And it's to buy a sandwich at a train station because I have to go far away. And so those things are difficult. Whereas in Edinburgh, you properly feel like you have colleagues and there's a lovely sense of camaraderie, I think.
Summer camp.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, like, I don't really get the... But, like, I think some people talk about, like, people being bitter in Edinburgh. And I don't know whether I've just had the good fortune that my friends have all tended to do quite well. And so it's nice to be able to just have a pint afterwards and be like, oh, yeah, it's going all right, isn't it? Like, we're going to be okay, I think. Mm. So I quite like that. Certainly I found last year in the... And only realised about two-thirds of the way through that, oh, the appreciable difference here is the absence of medication. That is the... it was the first time that I properly noticed that, oh, there is a stark difference when this stuff isn't... when I don't have this stuff.
And which is that... Do you mean up or down? A difference up or a difference down?
A difference down, like... Right, as okay. in, when I was doing Edinburgh 2018, was just physically and mentally spent at the end of every hour.
Yeah.
And then, particularly at the ones where I was lucky because it was doing well, so I had added extra shows at the weekends, and there was one of them where, like, 10 minutes before, I was just saying to my manager, I think that we're going to have to cancel this. I think I'm going to have a panic attack in this room now. And fortunately, he just, like, sat me down for a couple of minutes, so we can open a couple of minutes late, that's fine. If you want to, or we can pull it if you want to, either way. Yeah. And just did some sitting and breathing and drinking water, and it was all okay in the end. But yeah, I think that that's the first time that I've noticed its impact on one's physical and mental health, because it's the first time that I've been sort of like an established comedian and not on medication.
Okay. So when did you first get onto medication?
I think like 5 years ago now, something like that.
Okay. And was that after therapy, during, instead of?
No, it was basically, there was like a gigantic wait list for therapy. And so after a while, things just got bad enough that I was like, something needs to be done here.
Okay. Are you happy talking a bit more detail about what sorts of, like, what kind of, what's the primary challenge with your mental health?
It's just the little voice that won't shut up.
Okay. Self-criticism.
So, yeah, and worse. And so you just try to quieten that guy down a bit.
Has that always been there?
Yeah, but it sort of got worse over time. And I think, like, it's stuff like... Basically, there are elements of the way that my life has to go just because of the job that we do and what have you, that there's very little control that I have over that, like the being alone for extended periods of time, not talking to people, not, you know, like being strange, like paradoxically doing this extremely social job while not having social interactions because of the social nature of your job, yeah. Which just are inherently not good for us as an animal. This is not the way that we evolved to live. Unfortunately, well, fortunately in the sense that I love comedy and I love doing comedy, but it is the sort of corner I've painted myself into, which exacerbates certain things. And so... need to find a way of dealing with that.
And so do you feel like it's the price, like those negative circumstances are the price you pay for being able to do the job you love? Yes. Like I like a big issue with me is there's no routine. Mm. I think routine's really good for mental health and our jobs have no routine.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I have to try and impose a routine on my job, but it doesn't work. I never go, oh, Wednesday will be my day off. Do you want a gig on Wednesday? Yes, of course. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like to sort of struggle through trying to impose a more healthy structure on an inherently difficult life. I mean, I drive, so I'm not often on trains, but I discovered this has made me so much happier in the last year, listening to podcasts in which I learn about things that are nothing to do with comedy. Yeah. I'm obsessed. I'm not a property investor, but I'm learning a lot about property investing because I like the hosts and I enjoy the show. And I listen to a money podcast. I learned how inflation works. I'm like, now I know what inflation is. That's great. So, like, that's been really useful, but it's been years and years of, yeah, I mean, the isolation I find very, very difficult. And do you have any successful, almost like, you know, depression hacks? Do you have any kind of like successful things that you do, that, you know, structures that you can give yourself that that make it a bit more manageable.
Yeah. One of the very annoying things is being told repeatedly by your GP and everyone, eating better and exercise, eating better and exercise. And you're like, well, I desperately don't want that to be true. So let's,
I'll do anything to not feel like this. Go for a run. Well, not that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then when you actually remember to do that sort of thing, you're like, oh, right, this does actually have a
absolutely
noticeable market
impact.
So, yeah, just that sort of thing, which is the usual advice, really. Like, most of the usual advice works.
And do you do it? Do you stick to it?
No, of course not. This is the problem. Like, it's I have the best intentions in the world I wake up, but it's just the thing of, like, as you say, when there's no routine and you try to make the routine of, oh, this is the time when I will do that or cook or go for a run or what have you, and you just end up not. And, yeah, I think that, but that'll be sort of one that over the course of the coming period, I think I want to get a bit more on, because the spring was not pleasant. So
when you're writing about your, so the what is the subject of your show at the moment? Is it, what's the new show? Can you tell us what it's about, or what it is turning out to be about?
I think it's going to be about sort of belief. How have I described it? This is good. This is going to be me coming up with an elevator pitch on the spot. This is nice. This
Happy
will be
to
useful
help.
In the future. It's about sort of belief, life, existence in an absurd world, the rational response to existence within an absurd world, why we feel like we can't continue, why we do continue.
And when, I mean, that sounds like a typically jam-packed, concept-heavy, not necessarily in an unwieldy way. I think in my hands, that would be very unwieldy. You know what I mean? Like, that's...
I've also got loads of jokes about Mexico.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. But this is, you know, this is absolutely one of your strongest suits, is your ability to condense those things, to make those things palatable and accessible whilst being sort of huge topics. When you are covering big topics... Like, I noticed a bit that you did, I think, in Australia, it's on YouTube, when you were at Melbourne, there's like a comedy up late, I think. You were talking about, you've a very, very funny bit, which I think I've seen you do live as well, about Googling on your iPhone whether or not something is fair trade.
Yeah.
So you're using, I will now butcher the bit, you're using a piece of technology built by Chinese slaves to establish whether African people have been mistreated.
Yeah.
That's so, I mean, case in point, huge topics. Very funny, right? You've managed to spike precisely the kind of internal, the hypocrisy of that, the paradox at the middle of it. Bang, got it. What kind of a challenge is it to you to do stuff that well? Like, do you get a topic, does that idea fall into your head, or do you spend hours going, how can I say what I want to say about this? What can I frame it in, maybe through the medium of the phone? Talk us through that kind of process.
But that, like, literally did come about because that is what I was doing in Tesco, and, like, doing that. And I was just like, oh, this is weird, isn't it? And so make a little note of it, do it on stage. And I think, like, importantly, it's, like, I think useful when you're a comedian to be like, no, I'm an asshole too. Like, I'm not being prescriptive about this. It's like, what else can I do? Like, I'm not going to not have a smartphone. So, and I'm not telling anyone else, like, this is the thing that you should do, or, like, oh, throw that in the sea. Or anything. It's just like, this is a statement of fact, and isn't the reality absurd? And all I guess that you're really doing is drawing attention to, like, look, this bit of reality is really absurd. Have you looked at that? So,
yes.
So all comedy is observational comedy, essentially.
Yes, yeah, sure. So in your current show, do you find, if you are writing about aspects of your mental health, or when you have in the past, do you find that... When I wrote a show in 2011 that was about my anxiety, and writing it was torture, because every time I wrote a thing, I would have to kind of, how do I feel about that? And then I'd end up feeling very negative and falling down an absolute fucking rabbit hole of, what is the truth of this? Oh, it is a bit bleak, isn't it? You know what I mean? And just sort of depressing myself. Are you able to maintain kind of a healthy distance from either the material about mental health or the material about one's own hypocrisy? Can you maintain a distance from from implicating yourself in it and that making you feel negative?
I think that it's the sort of thing that, even like outside of the realms of comedy, these are the sorts of things that one has to maintain a slight distance from in one's own head. Otherwise, you would just immediately jump off a bridge. So I think you do have to maintain that. I think that working with Adam helps a lot in that, just having an external voice of being able to, like, oh, we can talk this through together. And it helps that when, because we feel like we're having a bit more of an objective conversation, he and I, then it feels like a bit we're talking about something that someone else has put on the page.
Yes,
and
okay.
How do you and I feel about what Ahir is saying there?
Sure.
And that helps, I think, get a bit of the distance from it.
And can you give us an example of a big topic that you haven't been able, like something that's kind of, that's frustrated you because you haven't managed to get it into the right words yet?
One day I will manage to write a stand-up show about... Right, I've got this theory. So, basically, Nietzsche writes about the death of God in the mid-19th century and means by that the loss of primacy of the religious impulse within Western politics and the way that Western statecraft is done, right? And Western society more generally. And so it's like, how do we proceed in this godless world when we no longer have the anchor of some absolute moral truth or what have you? Nietzsche is wrong because, in some sense, the apotheosis of, which is, I suppose, a strange word to use in the sense, but...
I don't understand what the word means.
Bringing up to the level of godhood.
Oh, I understand. Okay, yeah.
Right. But I feel as though, like, a lot of the implications of Christianity continue through Marxism. And so the Christian mode of organizing society does not end until the Soviet Union collapses. And so I think that that's why when you got people talking about the end of history, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they are talking about a very particular type of history ending, because that is when God properly died. And that, I think, is why you see in the contemporary world, like, the mass rise over the last 20 or 30 years of, first, you had an attempt at a third way, but now in backlash, you have sort of secular and theocratic fascisms creeping back into existence and hardline modes of organizing societies, which lay claim to some absolute moral truth, because this has been the only period in human history where we've properly lost God and we still need it as an animal, I think. And so that sort of God-shaped hole has to be plugged by something. And I think that we get into the Gramsci thing of the old world is dead, the new world cannot be born. In the interregnum, many morbid symptoms appear. And I think that we're living through the morbid symptoms at the moment. One day, I'll work out how that's funny.
Okay. But you'll work out how it's funny because it strikes you as to be internally funny somehow, or you'll work out how it's funny because you want to talk about it, and in order to talk about it, you have to make it funny.
Both. I think it's absurd, so I think it's funny.
Okay.
But, there's funny stuff in there. But, like, as I say, like, if you could unpack that, or sorry, pack that into a zip file and unpack it in people's heads, that could work really well. Actually, in his last show, Hail Mary, Sean McLaughlin talked about similar topics and I think did it very, very well and in a very funny, very interesting way. And so when I watched that show twice in the end, and both times I was just like, ah, he's got a lot closer to doing it than I have, hasn't he? Like, that's annoying.
And is that because let's bring it back to you. Could you write a show about that? Maybe it doesn't lend itself to a one-liner or even a 10-minute bit.
Mm.
Could that joke, could what's absurd about that, could that be an entire show?
Yeah, potentially. It probably would take longer than a one-liner to get across, I suppose.
Like, I feel like you describing that is the most intelligent individual nugget that anyone's ever said on this podcast in something like 300 episodes. And there's some higher level intelligence.
I'm sure some listener will write in to explain why I'm deeply wrong.
I mean, listen.
Which I may well be. I still haven't discussed it with anyone else.
So you can make the case.
But yeah, I think, it's going to be like, you could easily have a show about, like, the necessary search for God in a godless world, and how we react to the divine in a society that's given up on it, like, that's easily doable. I've got stuff about that that's going to be in the new one.
Who are your peers amongst comedy? Who else is covering this sort of territory?
Well, I think, like, lots of people are covering this sort of thing. Like, Sean being a great case in point. Like, I think often... because, like, I think he is someone who works very well on two levels. Like, just, like, the ludicrous joke about having cum on his backpack and something really incisive about Christianity. Like, and he can do both within the thing. And there's something to appeal to head and heart and throat and gut and all of that when you listen to someone like him. So people are doing it, no doubt.
But, I mean, I feel now that there must be a whole... are there lots of comics doing that kind of thing that I simply don't have the intelligence to gather that that's what they're doing? Or are you and Sean outliers in that respect?
I don't know. Like, I think that...
Like, name five other comics that are doing that kind of stuff, because I'd love to... You know what I mean? Like, I've seen Sean do half an hour in a festival, which was a really good... I mean, which is fantastic. And I didn't get that from it. Maybe he was doing the clubbiest bits of the show. You know,
yeah,
I didn't.
He was doing
I'm sure he was. I didn't see that show. I'd love to have seen it. But like, I suppose what I'm asking is it a case of your perception, meaning that you pick up on what comics shows are really about in a way that maybe they themselves, I don't mean this specifically about Sean, in a way that they themselves are less aware? Or can you point to lots of people who are doing very intellectual work which sits beneath the surface of a sort of accessible...
I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Or, like, in terms of perceiving things that others might not perceive in their own
stuff. I feel to an extent,
there is something like... Because Adam will often say to me, like, oh, you know that that's really what you're getting at there.
Okay.
Am I? It's like, yeah, well, it's obvious if you, like, go, okay, like, two thoughts deeper into the rabbit hole. And you're like, oh, yeah, actually, when you put it like that, now that you've taken a step back and looked at it, maybe that is what I'm saying. So maybe there's a bit of that. But I think we go back to the thing about comics being united by means rather than ends, right? And so if you can do a show about some mental theory that you've got about the development of society over the last few hundred years and can make that funny, then do that. If you want it, like, the funniest hour I've ever spent is with Emo Phillips, and that's, like, that's also fucking fantastic. So it's just, it's the wonderful freedom of being able to take this form absolutely wherever you want to, on the proviso that it's fundamentally built out of jokes. That's all you need to do.
I often finish my interviews by asking people if they're happy. I'm aware you're on antidepressants at the moment. Are you happy?
I don't think so, no. I'm just remembering the end of Grease where... It's like, I'm not happy, no, but I think I know how I could be. And so I'm just going to walk out of here, light a fag and put on some leather trousers. And so all of a sudden be like, all it took was denying every aspect of myself in order to fit in with a boy. Like, that's all. No, I don't know if I'm particularly happy, but relatively sort of boring emotion, isn't it? Like, or not complex emotion anyway. I feel like I'm interested in things, and I'm excited by things, and I think that that is enough for the moment until happy comes back, and I feel like it will.
Thanks, man. So that was Ahir. Really good fun to talk to him. Thank you so much to Ahir for coming along, and again, thank you for being so candid. As you know, I love it when guests are prepared to go into a bit of detail about their mental health, because I genuinely think there is a value in all of us talking about it. And I'm always very grateful when guests on the show are prepared to share something with us that is not something they would normally share with the general public. So thank you once again, Ahir. Thank you, of course, to the Bill Murray Pub and Barry and everyone there at the Angel Comedy for the use of the recording space. Thank you to Nathan Wood for producing the show. Thank you to podcast consultant Peter Dobbing. Thanks to Rob Smountain for the music and all of the usual people. Jake Crossland, of course, for logging And all of that useful stuff. That's everything. I will post Amble at you in a moment, but brilliant Danny McLaughlin has just walked into the green room here at Hot Water, so I'm not going to subject him to it. I'll record it separately now, but that won't make a difference to you because you'll hear it after this noise. So time for a post-amble now, having relocated both in terms of space and time. I hope you enjoyed this one with her here. I was going to say something about how pleasant he was to talk to and how inspiring he was to talk to. And I stopped there because I also wanted to say something along the lines of, and I really hope he sorts his head out as well, because, you know, we all need to sort our heads out. I'll leave it there because I don't want to say anything too trite about anyone's mental health, because, come on, we're all struggling with things to a greater or lesser degree. But anyway, really enjoyed talking to Ahir, and good luck to him for finding the happiness that you would imagine someone with Ahir's talent and skill and success would enjoy. Now, I say blithe because that's something that's been occurring to me a lot recently, the relationship between happiness and success, and whether there is a relationship, whether actually success makes people happy, or whether happiness makes people happy and success just makes people successful. And there doesn't seem often to be much of a link between those things. I'm no longer talking specifically about Ahir. That's merely a kicking off point. So let's leave him happily where he is. And I hope you do enjoy lots of his work. But two things made a real impression on me this last week, one of which I'll maybe, the success happiness thing, I will maybe talk about in more depth when I talk to you after the Paul Smith interview, because in Liverpool, as I mentioned, I had a fantastic interview with Marcus Birdman, and then a really, really invigorating one with Paul Smith, who, as you may know, has become hugely famous and successful in Liverpool, and hugely successful online and kind of internet famous around the rest of the country and perhaps world. And he seems to have, we'll get into it more when you hear the interview, but one of the things that's fascinating about Paul is that he doesn't really give a shit about success. And very rarely do you see someone who can fill an arena who genuinely, and you know, a lot of very successful people affect this idea of, oh, you know, I don't care, hey, it's nothing to me. I mean, do they? That's not a popular thing. But anyway, even when you do hear people say that, if you do, part of you thinks you can't possibly mean that. Well, Paul means it. Paul is happy. Paul is happy in and of himself and is hugely successful. And you get the impression that if the success ended tomorrow, it wouldn't affect his happiness at all. And that's something I've been sort of reflecting on this weekend. And I also want to talk about something that is maybe not even tangentially related, but something that I found incredibly stirring and that really kind of jolted me out of the sometimes comfortable position that I end up in as a podcaster and as a person who has a thing. You know, this thing is my thing, right? And it provides me a lot of joy. It provides me an outlet to talk to you. The interviews provide me interesting conversations. And I also am blessed with this sort of sense of legacy, however minor. You know, you and a lot of other people listen to this and you say nice things about it and you tell me it's affected your lives positively. And I suppose for a few years, I have been getting accustomed to that and getting quite comfortable in that. Like, I like that. Makes me feel good. I don't want that to stop. But the jolt came a few days ago when I was very lucky to speak to the advisory board of an excellent charity called Their World, all one word, Their World, which does fantastic work with children, vulnerable and underprivileged children, all over the world. They're an incredible charity, and I spoke about resilience and comedy, as that's my latest thing I'm doing, in a serious but amusing way, and I spoke to their advisory board,
and there were lots of high-level people on that advisory board, but I had to follow the most extraordinary act. Now, had to follow is a very comedy way of looking at it, and they weren't an act at all. They were a real person. So let's try and take this out of stand-up terminology. In comedy terms, if someone is blitzing it before you, like at Hot Water over the weekend, a few of the gigs I had to do, I had to follow Mandy Knight, who is as close to a bomb-proof comedian, just an explosion. Just, I mean, the audience, they literally, she was in the middle spot on a Saturday night and the audience were on their feet. Like, I mean, it was incredible. And I'm there in the wings going, oh God, I've got to follow this. And, you know, that's scary. So as a comic, you might think, oh, I've got a hard act to follow. That's where we get that expression, of course. So if you've ever done, some of you might have done sportsman's dinners or something where the act that you've had to follow is simply an incredibly famous sports person. Who knows? If you're lucky, maybe they're doing a bunch of jokes that have been written for them or even some old jokes that definitely kill every time. And you're there watching it having a very different flavour of like, how can I, this is a different tone. Well, at this charity board, the act that I had to follow was one of the most passionate and engaging speakers and talking about one of the most kind of, I mean, awful, horrifying and sort of optimism and anger despite awful circumstances. This lady was called Yasmin Sharif and she is the director. She is something high up in an organisation called Education Cannot Wait. And you can find them she is the director. You can find them at educationcannotwait.org. And they are a global fund for education in emergencies. And they are either at the UN or something to do with the UN. The details slightly elude me because the passion with which Yasmin spoke. This isn't a promotional plug for a charity, although the work they do is fantastic. They reach over a million children in some of the world's worst crises, and they support the idea of taking vulnerable children in difficult situations, and those, inverted commas, difficult, that might be war-torn, corrupt environment. You know, it's awful, awful, some of the world's worst, most challenging places to live, and making a difference to them in terms of education. This is not simply a plug for them, but in a stand-up, in a kind of an audience way, the way that Yasmin spoke with phenomenal passion about this incredibly difficult topic, and the story she was telling was visiting migrant children in Greece in refugee camps in the worst conditions. And Yasmin was talking very passionately about angrily demanding of the authorities and of the people, the authorities in Greece, many of whom want to help but are unable for numerous reasons. And she talked so passionately. Now, obviously, part of me is, 99% of me is gripped and wrapped by this story and how genuinely meaningful it is. And the way in which she told it was just extraordinary. And 1% of me was thinking, Jesus, how am I going to follow this? Do you know what I mean? Now I'm going to go on and talk about how comedy's hard and here's what we can learn from it. It all went well, thank God. But I just wanted to sort of reflect on that. And I suppose the wider point is what we can learn from other forms. You'll know that I'm a fan of RuPaul's Drag Race, and I'm very excited to see some British comedians are going to be on RuPaul's Drag Race UK. There's going to be some guest and repeating judges. I think Graham Norton's doing it. I think Alan Carr's doing it as well. I'm a big fan of Drag Race, and there's a gear shift. Big fan of Drag Race, and you have heard me say on the podcast before, comedians can learn a lot from drag queens. We can learn a lot from performers in different genres. We can probably learn a lot from concert pianists if we only knew how to interpret it. I suppose watching a show like Drag Race gives you a lot of backstage, behind-the-scenes information as people are tussling with trying to express themselves, their true selves, through a character which they have contrived. And that is, you know, that's like a very extreme metaphor for some aspects of stand-up. I just think that we can probably learn from speakers who are nothing to do with stand-up. Now, I get lots of emails from people who enjoy this show and who, I mean, the one that always sticks in my head is the guy who said, I'm a lecturer to dental students and I'm getting a lot out of the podcast. I always remember thinking, my God, wow, you know, that's so exciting.
of course, I'm just merely sort of putting this in as a reminder to me and to us all, we can learn from people in a huge variety of different situations, different professions. It's very easy to think that, oh, comedy, hardest game in the world. You know, we've got it tough. I've always imagined comedy. It's like trying to write a novel while people punch you. You know, it's hard. It's not as hard as directing a charity for refugee children. Come on. But it's, there is a lot to learn. For all that I swank about thinking I do a hard thing and people learn from it, it is always good to be reminded that I can learn so much more from everyone else than they can learn from me. So that's all I wanted to say. So you can certainly go to theirworld.org and you can go to educationcannotwait.org and look at the work that they're doing there. I hope to be involved in some small way with some of that work. That sort of it made a really big impression on me. But the point that I'm making is not simply that those charities are excellent, which they are. The point that I'm making from a stand-up perspective is that there is so much to learn from so many other disciplines. What can stand-up learn from kung fu or plastering? You know, those are my two go-to things that I can't do. I can't do kung fu. Absolutely cannot skim a wall. There we go. That probably sounded a bit serious and heavy. I didn't mean it to. But the point I'm making, the lighter point, is that there's so much stuff out there to learn from, isn't there? Drag, plastering, kung fu, a human rights lawyer. And I mean, there's got to be four other things, if not 4 million. All right, that'll do for now. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I did enormously. I'm so excited about the ones I've got in the can now. Birdman, Paul Smith, who have we got? Russell Hicks. So good. And, oh, this is final thing. Congratulations if you've listened this far. Join the Facebook group because there is a post on there where I reveal the guest of episode 300, and it's me. And I am not going to interview myself, but I am in cahoots with some excellent comedians who are friends of the pod, and they are going to put their questions to me in a series of interviews, and I'm going to chop them all together and put them in one episode. Should I reveal this? Yes, I'm only revealing it to those of you that bothered listening this far, which I know from the data isn't all of you. So if you would like to join the Facebook group, you can find the big mega post there. There's about 110 comments on it currently. I'm not going to promise to answer all of them, but if you've got a burning desire, if you've got a thing that you think it would be interesting to try and pin me down on, there's a lot of "are you happies" in there already. And someone, I think it was Nikki De Palma, commented, "Yes, but are you really happy?" There's lots of fun stuff on there. So now is your chance. And that'll do for now. Remember, comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get hold of the extras from not only "Are Here", but all of the stuff from the upcoming interviews with Hicks, Smith and Birdman. I've got, those are all about 2 hours long. So bags of extras coming along on the private feed soon as well. Bye-bye. Bye.
One-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.